welcome to the second of my podcasts on Scottish history. I thought I'd give a little overall picture on the status of the Scots nation and clear up a few misconceptions. Well, actually, before we do that, I've had some emails from listeners from the United States of America, and frankly, this has somewhat surprised me. I really never thought that I would gather an international audience with so parochial a subject, but listeners from anywhere are more than welcome. So, I hope you enjoy this. Anyway, is Scotland a nation in the normal sense of the word? One often hears of Scots' claims to nationality and patriotism. Indeed, we have our own parliament, we have our own state religion, we have our own judicial system, and we have our own sports teams competing on the world stage, so surely we must be. Well, we're not, actually. Our head of state is the Queen. Well, that's Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II to all you monarchists out there, and Lizzie Windsor to all the Republicans. And the Prime Minister, well, presently Tony Blair, but likely to have changed by the time you hear this, is the head of the government. We do have a devolved parliament with the First Minister in charge, and MSPs who are elected to manage our devolved affairs. If this sounds far too confusing, well, let's put our history hat on and delve into the murky past. From the mists of time, Scotland grew as a separate kingdom from England. There were squabbles, battles and wars over territory, but by the Middle Ages the border was roughly fixed into the positions it is today, running roughly northeast from the Solway to the Tweed Rivers. We had our own king, parliament, laws, institutions and religion. We were, by almost any standard of the day, a sovereign nation. Unfortunately, Queen Elizabeth of England died in 1603 without a direct heir. Her nearest relative was James VI of Scotland, he of the King James Bible fame, who was her great-aunt's great-grandson. You work it out. And so he was invited to take the crown as His Most Noble Majesty King James I of that name, ruler of Great Britain and Ireland. The name Great Britain was James's idea to try and bring two nations of Scotland and England together, as was the Union flag, which was the forerunner of the present British flag. And he recognised that the kingdoms, and of course his position, would be much stronger if he could try and defuse the long years of mistrust and warfare that had been going on for centuries. But he left the Scots institutions alone, preferring to rule from far wealthier London, simply appointing someone to rule for him in his name. Indeed, on his only return to Scotland in 1617, he lectured the Scots on the superiority of English civilization. Not a tactful thing to do, one can imagine. Now, the civil wars of the mid-17th century led to the first time the two nations were politically merged. Oliver Cromwell's parliamentary army effectively defeated the Scots Royalist army at Dunbar and subsumed the Scots Parliament into the English one. Now, but following the restoration of Charles II in 1660, the status reverted to as it had been before, with the monarch in London appointing a representative to sit at the Scots Parliament in Edinburgh, so one kingdom, two states. Now, by the end of the 17th century, the English were economically and politically building an empire in the Americas, but excluding the Scots in their endeavours. We were not given access to English colonies for trade, so we were suffering economic hardships. At the same time as famines and plagues, there were religious wars going all over the country. The 1680s became known as the Killing Time, and not because they were bored either. Now, a man called William Paterson was born in Dumfries in southern Scotland in 1658, and as a young man he went to the West Indies and then to England to seek his fortune. He became the founder of the Bank of England. Yeah, the Bank of England was founded by a Scotsman. And he peddled a grandiose idea to the English and Dutch governments. They gave the idea short thrift, so he returned to Scotland to see if they would bite. And bite they did. The Darien scheme, as it became known, was one of the most monumental cock-up the Scots ever had. Believe me, we've had a few. As an idea, though, it was brilliant, but in execution it was a farce. It involved the setting up of a colony in a place called Darien, close to the present-day Panama Canal. The idea was to have two towns at either end of the isthmus and employ natives. Well, I use the word employ, but let's be honest, they probably would have just been slaves, to bear cargoes between the two towns, thus saving ships from traversing Cape Horn in South America, charging ship owners for the privilege, and thus making a fortune. Now, Patterson's company is estimated to have raised nearly a third of the entire wealth of the nation at this point. Now, the company for trading to Africa and the Indies, as it became known, tried to raise money from England and from Holland, but the English Parliament made it illegal for English companies to invest and pressured the Dutch to do likewise, meaning that the Scots had to finance it themselves despite being one of the cash-poorest nations in Western Europe. Without going into too many details, it was a disaster. We conveniently forgot one salient point. The land for New Edinburgh, as first town became known, was claimed by Spain, and the reason they had not actually colonised it was because it was a malaria-infested, godforsaken swamp. 2,000 Scots colonists lost their lives, and the dreams of a nation died. To give you some idea of the incompetence, of the cargo taken in the first wave of settler ships in 1698 were several crates of wicks. Hardly likely to be used in a tropical climate, but there you go. There was much resentment at the perceived lack of assistance from the English. They had blocked access to investment, refused assistance from English West Indian garrisons when the Scots faced Spanish attack, and even refused access to safety in Jamaica for a small group of survivors. All of this despite the monarch of Scotland being the same person as the monarch of England, namely King William. After William's death, his niece Queen Anne came to the throne at the age of 37. She had had 18 children in 16 years, a remarkable feat made even the more remarkable by the fact that 12 were stillborn and the remaining 6 all died in childhood. She came to the throne in 1702 effectively childless and without an heir. Because of this, the English Parliament passed the Act of Settlement in 1701, confirming the heir as her distant cousin Sophie of Hanover and her offspring. Sophie's son was the eventual George I. Unfortunately, the English forgot that Scots had a say in this too. It was their monarch after all, too. And they passed an act which would allow the estates, or as the Parliament, Lords and Kirk were known, to decide when the time came who they would have as monarch. The English didn't like this idea. They feared that if the Scots selected the exiled Catholic James, Queen Anne's brother, and reunited their traditional alliance with France, it would lead to English defeat by their arch-enemy, the French. So in a tit-for-tat ruse, they passed the Alien Act, thus crippling the Scots' economy, which was already depressed because of the Darien failure. Some Scots nobles were facing ruin, and they thought it was time to try and negotiate with the English, and some in England also felt likewise. After several years of protracted negotiations and discussions, Queen Anne signed the Act of Union in 1707, effectively closing the Scots Parliament, and allowed Scots MPs and lords to sit in the English Parliament. The Scots had negotiated to keep their religion, the Calvinist Church of Scotland, and their own legal system, but all new laws were to be passed in the English Parliament. The Scots gained the right to trade, which was their main requirement, but subsumed their independence. It was not a popular move amongst the people, and riots broke out in Glasgow and Edinburgh, and most of the people again were dead set against it. It was felt that the noblemen in Parliament had used their leverage with England to recoup their losses arising out of the Darien scheme, and as the poet Robert Burns somewhat sentimentally 90 years later put it, "O would or I had seen the day that treason thus could sell us. My old grey head had lain in clay with Bruce and loyal Wallace. But pith and power, till my last hour, I will make this declaration. We are bought and sold for English gold, such a parcel of rogues in a nation." We were now akin to one country, the United Kingdom of Great Britain, with two states, Scotland and England and Wales, a bit like the American states in a way. It was to stay like this for nearly 300 years. There were clamours for independence, but much of it was based on the romantic ideals similar to those expressed by many small groups in Europe in the 18th century. Now, the Scottish National Party is a political party dedicated to peaceful, democratic campaign for full national independence of Scotland. It was formed in 1934 and gained its first UK parliamentary seat in a by-election of 1945, only to lose it 3 months later at the main national election. But by 1974 they had gained 11 MPs and nearly one-third of all the Scottish popular votes. In 1979, the Labour government, under pressure from the Nationalists, held a referendum on the subject of devolution. The vote failed narrowly, although 52% voted yes. The government put a requirement of 40% of the electorate, i.e. all those eligible to vote, not just those who actually did, to be a majority, and this was not reached despite a turnout of over 60%. The next change came with the election of Tony Blair and the Labour Party in 1997. Now, they had a manifesto commitment on devolution. Now, this referendum was positive, and so on 1st of July 1999, a devolved Parliament reopened. At the signing of the 1706 Act of Union, the Scottish Lord Chancellor was heard to say, "Now there's an end to an old song." At the opening of the Parliament in 1999, the veteran Scottish parliamentarian and nationalist Winnie Ewing said, "The Scottish Parliament, which was adjourned on the 25th of March 1707, is hereby reconvened." We are perhaps not a full nation in the usual UN sense of the word, but we have the trappings of such. We gain great benefits to being part of the UK and the Economic Community of Europe, but manage to maintain a sense of independence and patriotism which comes from being a nation state. Perhaps we will go all the one day, perhaps we will go all the way one day, but one thing is clear. If we do so, it will be by democratic, inclusive political means, and no other way would suit the vast majority of us. Well, thank you for listening, and please send me your feedback and thoughts. It gives me a really great buzz to get emails from around the world from towns I've never heard of and places I'll never see. I've got a new, simpler email address for you if you wish to write to me. It is scotshistory@gmail.com. That's Scots, S-C-O-T-S, history, all one word, @gmail.com. So thanks for listening, and until next time, slantcha.